You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
All right. So if you've been with us here, last week God established that he was going to feed the Hebrew people and give them water as they went through this desert journey. He's going to provide for them. And they're still heading down southeast toward Mount Sinai. Verse 8 in Exodus 17, while people of Israel were still at Rephidim, the warriors of Amalek attacked them, the Amalekites, another nomadic tribe that circulated all around, and they were picking off stragglers off the end, and then, it was basically they saw an opportunity for plunder here, food, some of that Egyptian gold, and slaves. So very common to have warring, raiding tribes around. Moses commanded Joshua, choose some men to go out and fight the army of Amalek for us. Tomorrow I'll stand at the top of the hill holding the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did what Moses had told him, and he fought the army of Amalek. And meanwhile, Moses, Aaron, and Hur climbed to the top of a nearby hill. So these all three, Aaron and Hur are brothers to Moses. And so these are like three guys in their 80s up there. They can't partake in the battle at all, except that they've got the staff of God. As long as Moses held up the staff in his hand, the Israelites had the advantage. But when he dropped his hand, then the Amalekites would start to get the advantage. Soon, Moses' arms became so tired he couldn't hold them up. So Aaron and Hur found a stone for him to sit on, and then they stood one on each side of Moses to keep holding up his hands, and so his hands held steady until sunset. And as a result, Joshua overwhelmed the army of Amalek in battle, and the remainder ran away. This is often taken as a picture of prayer, which I don't know whether it's necessarily prayer, but it could be. It definitely, God was showing them that they had to depend on his power for victory. And he had to show them repeatedly. If this had just happened once, Moses had his staff up and we did pretty well right then, that could be a coincidence. It's the multiple times happening and the same thing happening. That's how it becomes persuasive. And so that still happens today. We'll get it. Yes, God, it has to be your power in ministry and serving. And that's what I have to depend on, not on my own, but we keep going back to the other. And so we have to be reminded and he allows the battle to go against us. Yeah. I notice you win a battle like this, that would be a pretty good time to get a big hit, you know? Guess we showed them. So God's moving to block that. He doesn't want to see that. I was just talking to someone the other day, and it turns out we have a couple dozen home churches in our fellowship that don't have a prayer meeting. What do you think about that? They must feel like we're so awesome, we don't need to pray. We can just take care of business ourselves. Every one of them is doing poorly too. So that's not that surprising. This question here, is the prayer meeting the most important meeting of the week? So I kind of feel like it is. Here's where we get our power, it's from God. And it's also good for, you know, checking in with each other and finding out, you know, where one another's work and serving is going. And that's good for unity, praying together. I noticed that Hor and Aaron and Moses are all working together on this project to hold up his hands. And that may be kind of a picture of a corporate aspect of prayer where we come together. Well, after that victory, the Lord instructed Moses, write this down in a scroll as a permanent reminder and read it aloud to Joshua. I will erase the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar there and named it Yahweh Nisi, which means the Lord is my banner. He said, they've raised their fist against the Lord's throne, so now the Lord will be at war with Amalek generation after generation. So God's like, I'm going to get them for that. They actually continue to show up in the story of the Old Testament. They have a war with Saul, but it was actually David had another war with them, and they kind of disappear. You don't know too many Amalekites today, probably. None at all, in fact. Mostly they just got assimilated like most of these ancient nations. We don't know Philistines. We don't know Moabites, Edomites. They all just assimilated into other cultures and disappeared as a people. Not the Jews. God said, that's not going to happen to you. You're going to be here until the end of history as we know it. And sure enough, they're the only one of those peoples from back then that are still around today. That's a miracle. Well, Exodus 18, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, heard about everything God had done for Moses and his people, the Israelites. He heard especially about how the Lord had rescued them from Egypt. Apparently, he heard it from his own daughter because Moses had sent his wife, Zipporah, back with their two boys, back to stay with Jethro when things were getting too rough. And earlier, Moses had sent his wife, Zipporah, and his two sons back, and Jethro took him in. Jethro is also called Reuben, and earlier he's got more than one name. Well, Moses' first son was named Gershom, for Moses had said when the boy was born, I've been a foreigner in a foreign land. He named the second one Eleazar, for he said, the God of my ancestors was my helper. Both names relate to the stems of those two words. He rescued me from the sword of Pharaoh. Okay, why are we being told this? And there's just a lot of detail here. It keeps going. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, now came to visit Moses in the wilderness. He brought Moses' wife and two sons. And they arrived. Moses and the people were camped near the mountain of God. So they've made it all the way down to Sinai now. Jethro had sent a message to Moses saying, I, Jethro, your father-in-law, am coming to see you with your wife and your two sons. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law. He bowed low and kissed him. They asked about each other's welfare, and they went into Moses' tent. And Moses told his father-in-law everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and Egypt on behalf of Israel. He also told about the hardships they'd experienced along the way and so on. Again, why are we being told this? Well, how is this advancing the story? Jethro was delighted when he heard all about the good things the Lord had done for Israel as he rescued them from the hand of the Egyptians. Praise Yahweh, Jethro said, for he has rescued you from the Egyptians and from Pharaoh. Yes, he's rescued Israel from the powerful hand of Egypt. I know now that Yahweh is greater than all other gods because he rescued his people from the oppression of the proud Egyptians. And then Jethro and Moses' father-in-law brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God, and all the elders of Israel came out and joined them in a sacrificial meal in God's presence. When it's a praise offering or a thank offering, you just burn the fat portions and you keep the meat and you get to have a picnic. It's a barbecue. Well, one thing really strikes you about this Jethro vignette is that this narrative is written not by some, you know, forgers working 700 years later, as secular authorities like to say. Why would a forger put a story like this into the account? The one who put this in is the one whose father-in-law brought his wife and kids back. I mean, this was meaningful to Moses. That's why it's in there. Yeah, I find it impossible to imagine a later forger saying, well, let's put in some homey story about Moses and his kinfolk, so that'll make people think it's authentic. It's just, I hope you can see how bizarre that really is. Anyway, the next day, Moses took his seat to hear the people's disputes against each other. They waited before him from morning until evening. Tens of thousands of people, think how many disputes there must have been coming up, and so he's the only court. It's the Supreme Court is Moses. When Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, saw the people, what Moses was doing for the people, he said, what are you really accomplishing here? Why are you trying to do all this alone while everyone stands around you from morning till evening? They don't even form a line. It's just like a crowd saying, hey, we got a case here. Moses' answer, because people come to me to get a ruling from God. And so, he's not really taking charge much. He says, when a dispute arises, they come to me and I'm the one who settles the case between the quarreling parties. I inform the people of God's decrees and give them his instructions. Well, Moses was in there with God, so God might be talking to him as he goes along here. Or it's also possible this happened at the camp at the base of Sinai, so it might not be in chronological order, because Moses still hasn't, as far as our narrative goes, still hasn't received the ordinances of God yet. The revelation that he gets on the mountain. Yet he seems to know God's decrees and stuff. And we'll see later signs that this was written long afterwards, decades later, and might have put it before rather than after. They're not that worried about chronology and ancient writing as we are. Well, this is not good, Moses' father-in-law exclaimed. You're going to wear yourself out, the people too. This job's too heavy a burden for you to handle all by yourself. Now, listen to me. Let me give you a word of advice that God may be with you. You should continue to be the people's representative before God, bringing their disputes to him. But you should also teach God's decrees and give them his Torah teachings. Show them how to conduct their lives. But select from all the people some capable, honest men who fear God and hate bribes. So, bribery, huge, ruinous factor in so many nations' court systems. So there could be capable men, that's people basically wise, with an aptitude for judging and weighing cases, probably older guys. Men who fear, or which means to reverence or to believe, follow God. God first in their life. Men of truth, so they're trustworthy. They won't accept a lie. They won't excuse a lie. Men who hated all dishonest gain, all bribes. So, Moses thought about that, and he decided that might be a pretty good idea. Jethro went on, they should always be available to solve the people's common disputes, but have them bring the major cases to you. Now, if it's a Supreme Court case, they can bring that to you. Let the leaders decide the smaller matters themselves. They'll help you carry the load, make it a task easier for you. So if you follow this advice and if God instructs you to do so, then you'll be able to endure the pressures and all the people will go home in peace. Moses listened to his father-in-law's advice and followed his suggestions. He chose capable men from all over Israel and appointed them as leaders over the people. He put them in charge of groups of 1,000, 100, 50, and 10. So he's got a hierarchy of courts. These men were always available to solve people's common disputes. They brought the major cases to Moses, but they took care of the smaller matters themselves. So some pretty good advice from Jethro here. Soon after this, Moses said goodbye to his father-in-law, who returned to his own land and exits the narrative at that point. So he's basically teaching the importance of delegation and of equipping, right? Delegate this task. It's too big for you. Delegate it to other people, workers who can carry it on, and equip them, teach them the Torah, the teachings of God, so that they can, judge fairly. And so it's really a form of discipleship. He's equipping a group of leaders here. And you also see discipleship between Moses and Joshua. Joshua goes everywhere with Moses. He even goes partway up the mountain when he receives revelation. And it's clear that Moses is grooming Joshua, a much younger man, to become the leader when he's history. And that happened. And so there was a... However, when we look at Joshua, who did he disciple? Who did he raise up as his successor? Nobody that we're told of. And so you see a rapid plunge in the spirituality of the Jewish people after Joshua's life. And then we have the period of the judges where they're constantly drifting into idol worship and all kinds of things like that. Well, chapter 19, I'm moving well here. Exactly 2 months after the Israelites left Egypt, they arrived in the wilderness of the Sinai. So we left them last week there, and now they've made it all the way down to the tip of the peninsula, and they camp at the base of this mountain. After breaking camp at Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and set up camp there at the base of Mount Sinai. Then Moses climbed the mountain to appear before God. The Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "Give these instructions to the family of Jacob. Announce it to the descendants of Israel. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians. You know I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you'll obey me and keep my covenant, you'll be my own special treasure from among all the people on earth, for all the earth belongs to me. And if you'll be my kingdom of priests, my holy nation, this is the message you must give to the people of Israel," he tells Moses. So Moses returned from the mountain. He called together all the elders of the people, and he told them everything the Lord had commanded him. All the people responded together, and they were like, "We will do everything the Lord has commanded." So notice, God says, if they will obey me and follow me, then they will be my special treasure, and they'll be my chosen people. So it's conditional. And he's basically approaching them and saying, it's kind of like asking someone, "Do you want to get married?" God's proposing to enter this new covenant with them, the covenant of Moses, the Mosaic covenant, as it's known. And it's going to be voluntary. You want to do this or not? And they're saying, "Yes, we'll do it." And so they sign on the dotted line. But the Mosaic covenant is a conditional covenant. The enjoyment of blessings under the Mosaic covenant depends on your behavior. And so when we come to the book of Deuteronomy, he says, if you follow me and stay loyal, I'll do all of these things for you. You'll get great crops. You won't get sick. Your enemies won't come and defeat you. But if you turn against me and if you go to other gods, then you're going to be kicked out of your land. You're going to be defeated. There's going to all these different curses that are going to come down. So it's very different from the original covenant they were under, which is the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant was made initially between God and Abraham. And we can read about it in Genesis 12 and Genesis 15, a couple of later places too. And that covenant was not like, he says, he promised several things. You'll be my people. I'll protect you. You will, in you, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. This is to you and your seed. And I'm going to give you this land that you're standing in, which was Israel. And he doesn't ask Abraham anything. He just announces, this is the way it's going to be. And then when they solemnize the covenant, when they officially enact a solemnization, instead of both of them linking arms and walking through the the carcasses, which was a normal practice, God walked through by himself, so to say, I'll keep this covenant. And all throughout the Old Testament, the covenant with Abraham is always given as unconditional. Even though it's undeserved, even though they turn and become unfaithful, I will never, disown them as my people. The Mosaic covenant is not like that. And that Abrahamic covenant, so that is still in force today. And the Jews are still God's people in a very special way. This covenant, the Mosaic covenant, has now been superseded and it's no longer in effect. Jesus fulfilled all of this and brought a third covenant, really a fourth one, called the New Covenant. And that's what we're under. It's very much a covenant of grace. It's also unconditional and depends only on God to fulfill it once we enter. Authors like John Piper don't understand this. He says the promise made to Abraham, including the promise of the land, will be inherited as an everlasting gift only by true spiritual Israel, not disobedient, unbelieving Israel. He says this was plain in the Old Testament, for example, in the terrible list of curses that God promised to bring on the people if they broke his covenant and forsook him. That's in Deuteronomy 30 and following. Wrong covenant. That's the Mosaic covenant. Yes, it was conditional. But he's applying it to the Abrahamic covenant. Piper is clearly just wrong here. Listen, let's see what Paul says about it. The Apostle Paul, he's talking about the Abrahamic covenant, Abraham, how he was justified by faith when he believed God and so forth. And he goes down to say, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. This is the Abrahamic covenant. And he goes on about it. And then he comes back and says, the law, that's the Mosaic covenant, with the Mosaic law of Moses, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate the covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. Right there. Just because God enacted another covenant, the Mosaic covenant, does not abrogate the Abrahamic covenant. And Paul is very clear in here and in Romans 11 that the Abrahamic covenant is forever. And he says the gifts and callings of God are irrevocable, never revoked. And this theology that the Jews are history and they've been dealt out of dealing with God is called replacement theology. And they argue that us, the body of Christ, have replaced Israel in God's covenant. Wrong. We participate with Israel. We get some of the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant for us, including the part that God's using us to bless all nations on earth. So we participate with them. We don't replace them. That is a wrong teaching. Let's keep going. The Lord said to Moses, I will come to you in a thick cloud, Moses, so the people themselves can hear me when I speak to you, and then they'll always trust you. Not always trust you, but that they will hear when I speak and that you, and they may also believe in you forever. They were unfaithful at times. It's more saying this will establish you as an authority. So God is like, I'm literally going to let them hear me speak. They'll hear it for themselves out of a cloud. That'll blow their minds. Then the Lord told Moses, go down and prepare the people for my arrival. Consecrate them today and tomorrow and have them wash their clothing. Okay. Why are they washing their clothing? Well, why do you wash your clothes? It's because they're dirty, right? So that's a picture. Get rid of the dirt. Be in a purified state symbolically. Be sure you're ready on the third day, for on that day the Lord will come down from Mount Sinai as all the people watch. He says, mark off a boundary all around the mountain. Warn the people, be careful. Don't go onto this mountain. Don't even touch the boundary. Anyone who touches the mountain will certainly be put to death. So this is really emphasizing again what we saw in the the Passover, the separation of God from the people. We are not qualified to waltz into God's presence, to be accepted by Him. He's like, you are covered in sin. You're selfish. You violated my character. And I can't just look away from that fact. That counts. That's got to be answered. Justice must be served. And so that's a separation between the people and God. Isaiah 59:2, he says, your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. So this is the problem before us, and this is what God's going to solve this problem for us. Moses, on the other hand, can go through the barrier and he can go up the mountain because he is playing a role in this divine drama of Christ. He's the intercessor. And Aaron gets to cross it too because Aaron is the high priest of the people. And so he kind of plays it partially and Moses plays it fully. No hand may touch the person or animal that crosses the boundary. Instead, stone them or shoot them with arrows. So don't go up and drag them off to execution. Don't touch them. They become unclean. If you touch them, you're unclean. They must be put to death. And however, after the ram horn sounds, a long blast, then the people may go onto the mountain. So this is only temporary. Okay, none of this actually happened. All right? There's nothing about some people crossed the boundary and they got wasted. This is all imaginary, and it's strongly communicating this. Here's God, and here's us, and there's a big boundary in between there, and it's the boundary that causes death. It's really illustrating what we saw before: the wages of sin is death. So Moses went down to the people. He consecrated them for worship. They washed their clothes. Everything else to get ready for the third day. And until then, abstain from having sexual intercourse. Okay. What's this doing in here? Most of these are married people. But it does come up in the, as we go later into the various types of law, some of them target reproduction. And things having to do with reproduction. Because reproduction is associated with passing on the sin nature. And so this is like a reminder that you are born already with a sin nature. That's not something you get later on. So you have nocturnal emissions, you have menstruation, and then here in this case, and there's a few that target that. On the morning of the third day, thunder began to roar, lightning splashing, the dense cloud coming down the mountain. There was a long, loud blast from a ram's horn, and all the people start to tremble. This is pretty scary. Moses led them out from their camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain by that barrier, in front of that barrier. All of Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord had descended on it in the form of fire. The smoke billowed into the sky like smoke from a brick kiln, and the whole mountain shook violently. Sounds like a freaking volcano, doesn't it? There are no volcanoes in this area at all. Never have been. But if you see your Bible handbook or other reference tool that shows Sinai on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba to the east, it's because those are secular scholars who found a volcano there. And they're like, that's got to be where it is. And you're like, well, how did they get across the Gulf of Aqaba, even much wider than the Gulf of Suez? Well, they don't believe they ever did get across it. They believe this whole story is nothing but mythology, never happened. That's where they lived. That's where they came from. So we won't worry too much about that. If this was a volcano, then this story would be really false, wouldn't it? The story is saying this was God doing this, not that it was a volcano, like they wouldn't know the difference. As the blast of the ram's horn grew louder and louder, Moses spoke and God thundered his reply. The Lord came down on top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain, so he climbed the mountain. And so, yeah, it's not a real big mountain. It's, you know, hundreds of feet, not thousands of feet tall. That's a person walking there. You could walk up that in an hour or two, probably. This. I don't know why Moses in the center there is so much bigger than everyone else near him. Not great perspective, but it must have been something like this. I mean, there's light, smoke. Scared the bejeebers out of all of them. Well, when he got up there, God said, go down and bring Aaron back up with you. In the meantime, don't let the priests or the people break through to approach the Lord, or he'll break out and destroy them. Keep that separation. Aaron, the high priest, he doesn't know that yet, but God knows that he's going to be appointed to that. So Moses went down to the people and told them what the Lord had said. Chapter 20. Then God gave the people all these instructions, and he begins the famous so-called Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, which we're not going to study this week. The Ten Commandments, which is really not a good translation, it's the Ten Words or the Ten Sayings. This word's never used for commandment except in connection with the Ten Commandments, so it's wrong. We'll worry about that next week. We want to study this code of ethics that he gives because it's pretty broad and actually pretty deep and pretty insightful. The first half of it talks about your love for God. The second half, your love for your fellow human. The same two things that Jesus stressed, loving God with all your heart and loving your neighbor as yourself. So, yeah. Anyway, this whole thing with the thundering, lightning, the barrier, the shooting of arrows. My gosh, what is this? In this case, the New Testament interprets it for us. Book of Hebrews, chapter 12, at the end. He says to his Jewish Christian audience, you have not come to a physical mountain, to a place of flaming fire, darkness, gloom, and a whirlwind like the Sinai and the Israelites did at Sinai. That's our passage right there he's talking about. Notice he says, you have not come to that. That's not our covenant. It's not like our covenant at all. It's very different. They heard an awesome trumpet blast and a voice so terrible they begged God to stop speaking. That's in the Deuteronomy recounting of this account. They say that we can't stand, you know, we can't stand hearing this. Make him stop. And so they were like pretty alienated. They were told Moses, you go talk to him and then we'll listen to you. We can't stand listening to him talk to us. They staggered back under God's command. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. Wow, how hard line can you get? Well, I stress again, it never happened, but just even that thought. That's so hardcore. Moses himself was so frightened at the sight that he said, I'm terrified and trembling. This is again in a later recounting in Deuteronomy, but it's talking about the same event. Yeah. Moses was shaking. Everyone was. So you have this picture of this really frightening God. And when you're under law, God looks pretty menacing and pretty dangerous. He is dangerous. He's not the kind of being you'd want to run into on when you're on the wrong side of it. Pharaoh found that out. God is majestic. He's all-powerful. He's transcendent. To someone that doesn't have the grace, the gift of grace from God, is pretty scary too. People will run away, viscerally scared by the message about God. Yeah, fear, real common. No, our author in Hebrews goes on. He says, you have come to Mount Zion. That was Mount Sinai where the law came. That's not our mountain. Our mountain is Mount Zion. That's where Jerusalem was. That's where God led Abraham to one of the spires of that mountain to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. And of course, that never happened either, but it was a picture again. This is where the Jesus' cross and his resurrection happened, in Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Yeah, they knew about the new Jerusalem in the early church. The book of Revelation explains the new Jerusalem. That's kind of a picture of where we're headed in heaven. To countless thousands of angels in a joyful gathering. So instead of people trembling in fear, what do we have? People are rocking. They're partying, dancing around. It talks about Jesus and the great party he's going to put on in heaven. He says, you have come to the assembly of God's firstborn children, whose names are written in heaven. You come walking in there, and you're like, oh, Marty Faluzzi. Yeah. Been waiting for you. Come on over. This is pad I made for you. And he's waiting person by person. You've come to God himself, who is the judge over all things. You've come to the spirits of the righteous ones in heaven who have now been made perfect. So what a contrast. You've come to Jesus, the one who mediates the new covenant between God and people. And to the sprinkled blood, we studied that under the Passover, right? Sprinkling the blood. It's a picture of substitution, him dying in our place. Which speaks of forgiveness instead of crying out for vengeance like the blood of Abel. He had earlier pointed out when Cain murdered Abel that Abel's blood cried out from the ground for vengeance. Here is blood in a different setting crying out forgiveness. Right there. Crying out, yeah. And so he says, be careful that you don't refuse to listen to the one who's speaking. For if the people of Israel did not escape when they refused to listen to Moses, the earthly messenger, we will certainly not escape if we reject the one who speaks to us from heaven, the heavenly messenger, more authoritative than Moses, Jesus. Yeah, so his audience, many of them apparently were drifting away from the gospel. And a lot of them were second generation. Their parents were believers, but a lot of his readers aren't necessarily believers. He's not too sure about them. They're not acting like believers. And so there's also a classic mistake not to make here, which is thinking that just because God came and near to us in Jesus, that means he's not sovereign. He still is sovereign. People look at this and they're like, well, look at this God here on Mount Sinai. Look how different that is from Jesus. It's no different. Peter and James and John saw Jesus in his true appearance at the Mount of Transfiguration. It was so bright they couldn't even look at him. He's the same God. What's changed is our relationship to him. We're no longer relating to him by law. We're relating to him now by grace. And everything becomes safe at that point. He has done that for us. He's made a safe way. And so this picture of Sinai is set up as like a thesis antithesis for understanding what God's like. We wouldn't want to think that the God of grace couldn't hurt a flea, that he's weak, that he's lost. And actually, he never went soft. He went hard, and he went hard on himself. The full judgment of God poured out on Jesus Christ. Wow. So he's still transcendent. He's still powerful. Now, though, he's also close and gracious. Well, Paul talks about running up into and jumping into his lap and crying out, Abba, which is their version of like daddy, the affectionate name for your father, daddy. Wow, far out. I hope you'll come back for that analysis of the breakdown of the 10 words, the 10 sayings. I think you'll get a lot out of that. Yes, Lord, this insight into your greatness and over against your grace is a profound thing. That someone as great and awesome as you really cares about us, that you have our name written on the waiting list to come in. Jesus said, I call each of my sheep by name. You deal with us that way. And your love is deep. It must be really deep to go through what you went through in Christ. So we pray that anyone here that isn't sure whether they actually know you personally or not will just feel free to call out to you in their own heart and just say, I want to know you. And if you're real, show yourself to me. And we're thankful for everyone that may have prayed that here tonight, God. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.